Last week we did a little review of where we are in the study of Bethel Old Testament. We found that we're a third of the way through. We've studied studies 1 through 6, and we saw the common theme there of how God prepares His people. You know, we talked about creation and God's divine intentions, how we screwed that up with disharmony, but then how God in His love reached down and selected a person in His family through which to reveal Himself to the world. And then He made promises and gave some disciplines to that family and put some uniting factors in place to tie that family together. And we're going to go on and talk more about that family in the coming today and in the coming weeks as well. Today you see the title is An Emerging Nation on the Way to Its Homeland. So you can kind of guess what that's talking about. We are now in the book of Exodus. And we're going to look at the Exodus event. And as they go through the wilderness, we're going to see what that had to do with the destiny, with the calling that God gave these people to be blessed, to be a blessing, and to be His people so that through them, all people on earth can be blessed. And we'll talk about that. To kind of bring us up to date a little bit too, we have also been memorizing concepts. And in our review last week, we looked at those concepts. We specifically looked at the concepts that Standard Bethel is going through. And if you're an in-depth Bethel, you now have all the concepts that you're going to have until we get back together in January. So your concepts that you have go through Deuteronomy, and just keep familiarizing yourself with those. We will have a test on December 3rd that will go into those concepts in detail. So just carry your flashcards with you and do what you can to help yourself memorize those concepts. But the ones that we have in the Standard Bethel class, on page 1 of your lesson, I have kind of plugged those in on how they fit with the lessons. For instance, study number 1, we talked about creation, right? That was the theme there. And it dealt with Genesis chapter 1. We have a concept in Genesis chapter 1, and that is that God created all things good. So there we have the concept that ties together with that study. Just one concept on that one. Likewise on number 2. Study 2 dealt with Genesis 2. And that study talked about God's divine intentions. And that's the memory concept for Genesis 2, is divine intentions. Genesis 3 then, we have the concept of disharmony. And disharmony we saw played out in Genesis 3 with the fall. And that's our concept there for Genesis 3. But then we also saw the disharmony repeated multiple times, so that we saw a good picture of all four disharmonies in play, and that is a disharmony with self, disharmony with others, disharmony with nature, and disharmony with God. And we saw those in chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 7, chapter 11. And what were those? Again, chapter 3 was the fall. Okay, chapter 4, the memory concept there, is brother's keeper. Okay, you have the disharmony of against others with murder there. But brother's keeper, that's what Cain said to God, am I my brother's keeper? Genesis 7, the flood. Okay, we've got the flood. And then Genesis 11 is the Tower of Babel incident. Okay, so those are the stories that go there. And they all kind of fit under that disharmony lesson number 3. Then lesson 4, the pivotal lesson, the Bethel lesson. Okay, blessed to be a blessing. And we talked about that. The pronouncement of the destiny. And it dealt with the selection that God chose Abram and his family for no reason that they were deserving of, but purely out of His grace. And the concept there is blessed to be a blessing. That's the theme, okay? Blessed to be a blessing is Genesis 12. And then we looked at the ardent dreams of a destiny. You remember the picture here where Israel is surveying off into the misty clouds of thinking about the promises that God had made and the disciplines that God put in place. And we saw a lot of it deals with separation. Okay, you've got the promises of land and a big family, lots of people and nations and kings and all that of these people. But we also saw the calls to be separate. Separate ethnically, separate within families, and separate geographically. And so the overall theme there of separation. And we see some of the memory concepts that we have in Genesis 13 through 50 deal with those topics. Genesis 13, we have what? Okay, after Abram's called in Genesis 12, the next chapter, we see how we have separation within families where Abram and Lot are separated. Okay, the covenant goes through Abram, not through Lot. So you have that separation. Genesis 16, we've got the next generation with Hagar and Ishmael popping in with that story in Genesis 16. Genesis 17, we see circumcision instituted. Okay, the whole concept of separation. They were called to be a separate cut-off people, and that's what the circumcision was there to remind them of their calling to be a separate cut-off people, set apart for God's holy purpose in this divine destiny. Genesis 24. There we deal with separation again, deliberate ethnic separation. Okay, where Isaac marries Rebekah. Genesis 47. Geographic separation in Goshen. Okay, so we have the concept of separation there. And then Genesis 50, our concept there is that God can use evil for good. A very powerful story that we have there with the story of Joseph, but also a key lesson that all these things, these promises, these disciplines, as we screw up, they still don't get in the way of God fulfilling His plan. God can take the stuff we screw up and still make His good happen, no matter how we try to get in the way. Okay? So that was study number 5, The Ardent Dreams of a Destiny, okay, dealing with separation. And then the study 2 weeks ago, before we did our review last week, is United for a Destiny. And we talked about the uniting factors that God put into place, the circumcision, the separation, the promises of land and nation, the oppression under Pharaoh, the law. All of those things serve to unite Israel together to enable and empower Israel to fulfill the destiny to which God had called them. Being blessed, to be a blessing, so that through them, God can bless all people on earth. And then in Exodus, we have some concepts that kind of fit into some of those things. In Exodus 2, we have the birth of Moses. Okay, the Monday night in-depth Bethel has a concept in Exodus 1 that deals with the oppression under Pharaoh. And so we see that our story tells us about the oppression under Pharaoh in chapter 1, and then immediately thereafter, we get the story of God raising up a deliverer, raising up Moses, the birth of Moses. Okay, it seems like it wasn't immediate, at least to the Israelites then, but it was in God's perfect timing that He did that. Okay, Exodus chapter 4. This is the excuses of Moses when faced with a challenge, or the way I like to put it, Moses has 5 reasons why he's the wrong guy for the job. And so we see that in Exodus chapter 4. Exodus 18. Exodus 18 deals with the advice that Moses got from his father-in-law Jethro on how to delegate responsibility. We're going to talk a little bit more about that one today. That fits a little bit in our lesson today, and so do the next ones. Okay, Exodus 19, the next chapter. Israel is a kingdom of priests. Okay, this gets back to that separation thing, that they were called to be a separate people, set apart for God's holy purposes. Exodus 20. Okay, that's an easy one, because you got 2 tablets, 10 commands, the 10 commandments. Okay? And so the 10 commandments, that's God's moral law. And then following that, in Exodus 21 through 23, we have God's civil law, or the concept is the eye for an eye code. Okay, the civil law. So those are the concepts that we have so far, and maybe that will help you tie them together with the pictures and the studies that we've had, so you can, maybe that will help you remember what goes where. Now, if we look at these last 3 pictures, okay, the first 3 pictures dealt with God's plan for all people, right? Dealing with creation and God's divine intentions and the disharmony, but then the promise of salvation to all people that God gave in response. The next 3 deal with this people that God chose, that God put into place through which He gave them this destiny so that He could reveal Himself and His plan and fulfill His plan to the world through them. If you look at the pictures for studies 4, 5, and 6, what is the very common element that you see in all 3 pictures? It's the prism, right? And that prism reminds us of what? Blessed to be a blessing. God said, I will bless you so that you may be a blessing, and through you all people on earth will be blessed. Now, if you look at those three themes, they all fit into the themes of those three pictures. Okay? God reached down and selected Abram and his family. Okay, so our first lesson dealt with selection. He said, I'm going to bless you. There was nothing that Abram did. There's nothing that his descendants did to deserve being picked. It's purely out of God's grace, out of God's great blessing of grace, that he reached down and selected them and chose them. It's purely out of his grace that he's called us as his people as well. Then we see that he blessed them so that they in turn would be a blessing, that they would be different, that they would be set apart for this unique purpose of being a blessing for other people or to other people. Okay? That would be a channel of blessing from God to other people. So they were set apart, they were separated from other people's for that unique destiny. So you've got separation tied to that concept of you being a blessing. And then, by you, all nations will be blessed. By you, all peoples, all through you, all peoples on earth will be blessed. So there we have the unifying factor, that this promise of salvation, the gift of salvation through God's grace, is offered for all people. No longer is there Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female, but all are one under the body of Christ. So we have this uniting factor of all people on earth being blessed through these people, through what God would do through these people. Okay? So that's the calling. That's the destiny. That's what Israel was chosen for. They were selected purely out of God's grace and set apart so that they could unite all people in one under Jesus Christ. Now, how did the prophets remind the Israelites of this calling? We'll talk more about the prophets in a number of weeks. But look at what Isaiah says in Isaiah 2 verses 1 through 5. This is what Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among mountains. It'll be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He'll teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He'll judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war any more. Come, O house of Jacob, let's walk in the light of the Lord. So, it's talking about here how people will flock to Israel. People will come to the Lord's mountain, okay, which is Mount Zion, there in Jerusalem. People will come to Jerusalem. People will come to the Jews to learn God's ways. So they were to live the destiny. Okay, that was their calling. Their calling was to live the destiny so that people would then be attracted to God through them. Okay? So in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief and all nations will stream to it. You see, that's the purpose, is to bring people to God. That's the calling that we've been given, is to bring people to God. Let's look at Zechariah chapter 8. There's another verse similar to this, verse 20 to 23. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Many peoples and the inhabitants of many cities will yet come, and the inhabitants of one city will go to another and say, hey, let's go entreat the Lord and seek the Lord Almighty. I myself am going. And many peoples and powerful nations will come to Jerusalem to seek the Lord Almighty and to entreat Him. This is what the Lord Almighty says. In those days, 10 men from all nations and kingdoms and languages will take firm hold of one Jew by the hem of his robe and say, hey, let's go with you because we've heard that God's with you. So people and nations will come to seek the Lord through the Jews. So, if you are the window, if you are the path, if you are the one through whom God is reaching out to grab others and bring people into a relationship with Him, well then be that person. Live the life that God wants you to live so that you can shine Jesus to them. Show them and attract people to what God has in store for them. So, That was the calling that God gave to Israel. How did they do? Well, how have we done? Israel is full of sinful people. And just as we fail, Israel failed in certain ways. So let's take a look at the time of Jesus. Jesus had some stuff to say about how Israel abused their calling, abused that destiny, abused those things that God put into place to help unite them and to help enable them to fulfill their destiny. Matthew 23, verses 1 to 7. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must obey them and do everything they tell you. But do not do what they do, for they don't practice what they preach. They tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is for men to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. Oh, they love the place of honor of banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and have men call them rabbi." Okay? So here, he's pulling out the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees was a group of people who focused on obeying God's laws. Okay? Or at least obeying God's laws the way they understood them. And they wanted to make sure that nobody broke God's laws. And so they made laws around God's laws to make sure that if you keep these laws, then that for sure is going to make sure that you don't break God's laws. And that became their focus. They looked at the laws and into themselves. They looked at the other things of being an Israelite, of being a Jew, as being into themselves, of circumcision, of separation, of all those things. And so they were the ones, the Pharisees were the ones that people looked up to. And if you want to know what it means to be righteous, then emulate a Pharisee. Okay, that's the way it was in Jesus' time. And Jesus says, this chapter here in chapter 23, is he points out and he says, hey, you know, these guys are your teachers, so you gotta do what they tell you. You gotta obey them because they're bringing God's word to you, but don't follow their example. They don't practice what they preach. In fact, they make it tougher for you than what God intended. Okay? What they do is focusing on themselves, not focusing on God's. They're flaunting their false righteousness. Okay? They think that they've been selected to show you what it means to be part of God's selected family, but they haven't. Okay? So they've screwed up the selection aspect. Okay, they're part of the Jews who have been chosen, but they're flaunting that, and that's not what the selection was all about. Okay, so they flaunted their false righteousness here. Okay, verses 13 to 14. "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves don't enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to." So they shut heaven in men's faces. These Jews were called to be a separate, cut-off people, set apart for God's holy purpose, for the destiny that God's entrusted to them. And yet, the Pharisees are not allowing them to do that. They've shut that destiny off from them. Okay? They've made it impossible for people to enter heaven. And then 23-24, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you've neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former, you blind guides. You strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel." So here is talking about how they made the law an end. They focused on the law and worried about the details of the law without recognizing that the law was a means to an end. It wasn't about the law, it was about the law was there to enable and empower them to fulfill their destiny to be a blessing to others. So that uniting factor of the law that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, they've abused that and made it an end in itself. And then verses 37-38, Jesus says, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you. How often I've longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you weren't willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. Okay? He says, I've longed to gather you together, but you were not willing. You have forgotten the destiny. You have not remained united to the calling that God gave you. Okay? So look, your house lies desolate there. So that's the problem that they had. Okay, God put these, gave them this calling, put in the promises and the separation disciplines and uniting factors to enable and empower them to fulfill that destiny. And they ended up turning those things into the ends themselves and forgot about the destiny. And so that when, by the time Jesus came, you see these hard-powered words that Jesus blasts at the Jewish leaders. So that's Israel's calling, and we'll keep getting further into it. But so you can see how the selection, the separation, and the uniting were all part of those things that were there to prepare and enable Israel to fulfill the destiny, but they turned them into ends themselves, and as a result, lost the destiny. And we'll keep going further into that. Okay, also some other memory concepts. We've got some new memory concepts from your homework on the second half of Exodus. Where do we find the civil law for nomads? Okay, we start out with the moral law in Exodus chapter 20. Okay, that's an easy one to remember. The two tablets, 10 commands, 2 times 10 equals 20. Okay, and then right after that we have the civil law for nomads. And we'll talk about that today, Exodus 21 to 23. We then in chapters, well, what chapters do we see the instructions to build a tabernacle? Chapters 25 to 27. Okay, 25 to 27. And again, we'll talk about all these concepts today. They all fit into today's lesson. Then the inauguration of the priesthood. Exodus 28 to 29. God equipping people for specific tasks. God equipping people for specific tasks. Exodus 31. The golden calf. Exodus 32. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children. Exodus 34. And then finally, God a constant presence in Israel's midst. Exodus 40. Okay, that's the last chapter of the book of Exodus. By the way, as you go through Exodus, it starts out with the Exodus story, with all the oppression under Pharaoh and the birth of Moses and Moses being called, and then it goes into all the plagues and let my people go, and then they leave and they go out, and you have the Red Sea, parting of the Red Sea incident. They end up within just a few days or not too long at Mount Sinai. And then what we have in the rest of the chapter of the book of Exodus is all happens at Mount Sinai, okay, until you get to the end. And then Leviticus, okay, the next book in the Bible, is more stuff that happens at Mount Sinai, or actually commands, ceremonial commands that God gave to the Levites. That's why they call it Leviticus, okay? It's having to do with the Levites. And so some of the religious laws that God gave for the Levites to take care of, that's what you have in there, and that was all given at Mount Sinai. And then you go to the Numbers, and so then you have they leave Mount Sinai, and then you have more of the story of their wilderness wandering. So we'll be looking a little bit at some of the stuff in Numbers as well. Then Deuteronomy is the second law. That's what Deuteronomy means, for the second word. And so what this is when Moses is with it's at the tail end of the 40 years. And they're about to go in the promised land. The people that are there now, the leaders there now, are the next generation. Remember, that first generation didn't trust God after the spies went in. And so God said, you're all going to die and your children are going to be the ones who go in. And so this is the children. And so Moses reminds them of everything that had happened and how God had revealed himself and his power and his love for them through that prior 40 years. And then that's what you have in the book of Deuteronomy, is Moses reminding them of all those things. Okay, so you'll see some stories in Deuteronomy that refer to things that took place in Exodus, because it's Moses retelling those stories. So let's look at some of this, okay? You'll see your picture here. You take a look at the picture. The concepts that we're going to discuss are not directly out of the picture. You just see the emerging nation on the way to its homeland. But let's talk about some of the things that dealt with that, okay? Let's start out. How many were in this emerging nation, and what did they bring along with them? They were leaving Egypt to go to this promised land of Canaan, right? How many went? And what did they bring with them? Exodus 12, 31 to 39. This takes place after the story of the Passover night, when the firstborn of all the Egyptians were killed. Picking up in verse 31, during the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, "Up! Leave my people, you and the Israelites. Go worship the Lord as you requested. Take your flocks and herds as you said, and go. And also bless me." If he realized this really was God involved here, right? "The Egyptians urged the people to hurry and leave the country, for otherwise," they said, "we will all die." Okay, God is against us here. "So the people took their dough before the yeast was added and carried it on their shoulders in kneading troughs wrapped in clothing. The Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. The Lord made the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the people, and they gave them what they asked for. And so they plundered the Egyptians. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Succoth. There were about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. Many other people went up with them, as well as large droves of livestock, both flocks and herds. With the dough they brought from Egypt, they baked cakes of unleavened bread. The dough was without yeast because they had been driven out of Egypt and didn't have time to prepare the food for themselves." So 600,000 men plus women and children, so 2 million plus people left, Israelites left in this Exodus. What'd they bring? They plundered the Egyptians, it said. God made the Egyptians favorable towards them because the Egyptians wanted to please the Israelites' God. All these plagues that had taken place were obviously from the God of these Israelites, and he's shown that he is the God of, with the power. And so not only did Pharaoh want to see them go to appease and to please their God, but so did all the Egyptians. So they gave them gifts to take and please the God with, and so silver and gold and clothing, okay, they went with. They also went with unleavened bread, okay, because they didn't have time for the yeast to make it rise. They were, so you see the urgency, the hurriedness at which they left. When they got the word to go, they had to go right then. So why did they leave? Why did God take them out of Egypt? Why didn't he just leave them in Egypt? They were fine. They were off by themselves in Goshen, right? Why did he need to bring them back to Canaan? Chapter 26 of Genesis, starting at verse 3. This is God talking to Isaac. He says, "Stay in this land for a while, and I'll be with you. I'll bless you, for to you and your descendants I'll give all these lands, and I will confirm the oath that I swore to your father Abraham. I'll make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I'll give them all these lands, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed." Okay? Why did they need to leave? Because their destiny was not in Egypt. Their destiny was their own nation of Israel. And God had prepared that place for them. Their destiny was to bless others, and through them all peoples on earth would be blessed, and that would happen from Canaan, not from Egypt. Canaan being a key crossroads. The major power in the south of Egypt and the major powers in the east, whether it be the Hittites or the Assyrians or Babylonians or whoever it is, wherever, if anybody wanted to trade with each other, that resulted in travel through Israel. So that brought people in contact with Israel and therefore gave them opportunities to be a blessing and gave them opportunities for people to know about the God of the Israelites so that God in turn could bless all people through them. Their reason for not staying in Egypt was because that was not the place of their destiny. Canaan was. Okay, well then why did God bring them to Egypt in the first place? Because they were already in Canaan. What the verse we just read in Genesis 26 where God was talking to Isaac, that was already in Canaan. Why did he take them out and bring them to Egypt in the first place? Genesis 15, starting at verse 13. Then the Lord said to him, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they'll be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. But I'll punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions." So what's it say? Well, it's part of God's plan, right? God said to Abram, "I'm going to take your descendants, and they're going to go to a country that's not their own. And they're going to be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. But I'll bring them back. And I'll bring them back with great possessions." And we see that's what happened. So God brought them to Egypt to build and prepare them to be a blessing. Because in Egypt, unlike in Canaan, they were able to be geographically separate and therefore ethnically separate. They were set apart by themselves in a land of Goshen, okay, where the Egyptians didn't stay. And so they were not polluted by the Egyptians. Whereas if they stayed in Canaan, there's lots of peoples in Canaan, the Hittites and Hivites and Perizzites and Canaanites and Jebusites and all these et ceterites that were there. They would have influenced and could have influenced the Israelites away from God. Okay? The other thing, Genesis 46, verse 3. "I am God, the God of your father," he said. "Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there." So another reason for not leaving them in Canaan, besides the impact and the influence that they might receive that would lead them astray from God, is that God wanted to turn them into a great nation. And Egypt was where that would be able to happen. Okay, so he brought 70 of them, Jacob and his descendants, his blood descendants at the time, numbered 70. And 430 years later, he brings them out in the millions. Turns them into a great nation. Now, as they go through the wilderness wanderings, okay, they spend 40 years in the desert, right? They send the slaves in, and the slaves come back and say, "Oh, this is a great area." And this is right at the beginning of their travels, right? And the slaves come back and say, "Oh, this is a land flowing with milk and honey. This is, God has blessed this place greatly, but the people there are like giants. They're stronger than us. There's no way we can take them." And 10 of the 12 tribes said that. Two of the tribal leaders said, "No. Yeah, you're right, the side's lopsided, but it's lopsided in our side because we have God on our side." And who was that? That was Caleb and Joshua. Caleb and Joshua were the spies who spoke up. And so as a result, how did God judge that? He said, as a result, anyone who's 20 years or older will not be able to enter the promised land. Okay, you're going to die off and it's your children who are going to be the ones who get to enter the promised land. Therefore, then, they went for 40 years wandering through the wilderness before the time was right for God to bring them into the promised land. Why? Why wait all that time? What was the purpose? Why? Okay, he's punishing them. He could have just struck them down or whatever and then gone back in. Why did they need that time out in the wilderness with God? Deuteronomy 29, verses 2 to 6. "Moses summoned all the Israelites and said to them, 'Your eyes have seen all that the Lord did in Egypt to Pharaoh, to all his officials and to all his land. With your own eyes you saw those great trials, those miraculous signs and the great wonders. But to this day, the Lord hasn't given you a mind that understands or eyes that see or ears that hear. During the 40 years that I led you through the desert, your clothes didn't wear out, nor did the sandals on your feet for 40 years. You ate no bread and drank no wine or other fermented drink. But yet you're here 40 years later. I did this so that you might know that I am the Lord your God." So what was the purpose of all the events and experiences that they had during their 40 years in the wilderness? God says, "I've shown you all this. I've done all this for you. There's no way that anyone can live for 40 years in the wilderness. There's no food. There's no drink. There's no anything. Right? And yet you've done it. You as a nation have done it. you have seen and experienced these things. Why? So that you will know I am God. So that you will know I am God. Verses 12 to 15. You are standing here in order to enter into a covenant with the Lord your God, a covenant that the Lord is making with you this day and sealing with an oath to confirm this day as His own people, that He may be your God as He promised you and as He swore to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am making this covenant with its oath, not only with you who are standing here with us today in the presence of the Lord our God, but also with those who are not here today. So here we see they were confirming the covenant for the people that were there, but also for the people that were yet to come, the descendants that were there but not there. Okay? They were part of these people, but they had not yet been born. And I am confirming this covenant. This is the covenant that God made with your forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And by doing so, it's a covenant He has made with you. And God is confirming that that covenant is for you. And so you've had these experiences where God has taken care of you in the wilderness so that you can see that the covenant and the promises that He made with your forefathers are covenants and promises that He made with you. The destiny that He gave your forefathers, blessed to be a blessing, is a destiny that you have. Turn to Joshua chapter 24. Some of the verse here may be a memory verse that you may already know. Chapter 24, starting at verse 14. This is Joshua speaking to the Israelites before he dies and giving him kind of his last words. And he says, "Now fear the Lord and serve Him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods that your forefathers worshipped beyond the river." Okay, beyond the Euphrates River. So this is like before Abraham with Haran and Ur. "And the gods that your forefathers worshipped in Egypt." So we see that they strayed a bit from God. "And serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you'll serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're now living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord." Then the people answered, "Far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods. It was the Lord Himself who brought us and our fathers up out of Egypt from the land of slavery and performed these great signs before our eyes. He protected us on our entire journey and among all the nations through which we traveled. And the Lord drove out before us all the nations, including the Amorites who lived in this land. We too will serve the Lord because He is our God." So you see they got it. After those wilderness experiences, they realized God has done all of this for us. He is our God. We are His people. We will serve Him. He did these things for us. So that's the purpose of the wilderness wanderings. How do you boil that down? What is it that God asked of the Israelites in the wilderness? Exodus 14, verse 31. "And when the Israelites saw the great power that the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in Him and in Moses, His servant." These experiences, these events that they had in the wilderness, what were they there for? To see that the Lord is God. They are His people, and that they can trust Him. They were able to live and exist for 40 years in the wilderness, a human impossibility, but they did it purely by God's provision, purely because the Lord is God, purely because they had to trust Him. They had no choice. They could not eat, they could not live if God had not provided for them. And so that taught them to put their trust in the Lord. Why did God leave them in the wilderness for 40 years? It wasn't just for that first unbelieving generation to die off. It was so that the generation that would receive the promised land learned how to put their trust in Him. Yes, those people in that Canaan area looked to be big and powerful and mighty, and you know, we can't stand up to them. They're stronger than us. But they're not stronger than our God. And so they needed to learn to put their trust in God. And we get to the stories where it talks about how the Israelites came and took the promised land. You'll see they couldn't do it on their own. All of those victories were victories that God gave them, where God personally intervened and made it possible. That all happened in the wilderness wanderings. Let's look at some of those, okay? And first, you may want to take out a piece of paper because we're going to kind of make something on the board in class. And take a piece of paper and just write across, trust in the Lord. That's what these experiences in the wilderness were all about. Teaching them to put their trust in the Lord. And it happened through a number of different ways. It happened through crisis and trials. Okay? Crisis and trials. So, one thing you can do on what you just wrote on trusting the Lord, write vertically, write crisis, so that the last S then becomes the S in trust. And then, under the T in trust, the last T, you can write vertically trials. Okay? So crisis and trials helped teach God's people to put their trust in Him. Let's look at some examples. We'll go to Exodus 14, verses 10 to 12. And this is when the Israelites are leaving Egypt, and Pharaoh changes his mind and decides, hey, I've just lost my slave force, and he sends his troops out, and he goes with them. And it says in verse 10, as Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us out here in the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. So here we see the crisis. They were afraid of the Egyptians that were chasing them and coming up, and they were afraid of this big Egyptian army that was coming after them. How did God respond to that? Next verses. Moses answered the people, don't be afraid. Stand firm and you'll see the deliverance that the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. And jump forward to verse 26. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen. In 29 to 31, but the Israelites went through the Red Sea, or Sea of Reeds, on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. But that day, then the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. And when the Israelites saw the great power of the Lord, that the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in Him and in Moses, His servant. So you see, they had this crisis. The Egyptians were coming. There was no way out. They were backed up against this sea. They couldn't go anywhere. The only way to go was towards the Egyptians. They had their backs against the sea. But what happened? God intervened, miraculously intervened, and safely brought them passage across that sea. And then when the Egyptians followed into the sea, He then brought the sea waters back over them. And this was obviously the work of God. And how did they respond? That verse 31, when they saw the great power that the Lord displayed, the people feared the Lord and they put their trust in Him. There you see, the first crisis they encountered, God intervened and it had that effect of teaching them to put their trust in Him. Exodus 15, 22 to 24. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they couldn't drink its water because it was bitter. That's why the place is called Marah. Okay, Marah means bitter. So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, what are we to drink? So here they have a crisis. It's been 3 days since they've had good water. They come and they find water out in the desert, but it's bad water. They can't drink it. It's sour, okay? It's bitter water. How does God intervene? 25 to 26, then Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord made a decree and a law for them, and there He tested them. He said, if you listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what's right in His eyes, if you pay attention to His commands and keep all of His decrees, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am the one who heals you. Okay? So God intervened and made the water sweet so they could drink, They had a need to drink, right? All these people needed water, and God provided them water. They got this bad water, and they thought, you know, if it was good water, they could chance upon it and say, oh, look, we found water. But no, they found water. And it was only by the power of God that that water could be drinkable, and that's what God did. Chapter 16. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to him, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you've brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. They didn't have any food. They needed to eat. They've eaten all the stuff they brought with them. What did they do? It's a crisis. So what did God do? Verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, I've heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Now tell them, at twilight you will eat meat. And in the morning, you'll be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. So Moses told the people, and then that evening, just like God said, quail came and covered the camp. In the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, what is it? But they didn't know what it is, what it was. Moses said to them, it's the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. So they had nothing to eat. Moses cried out to the Lord for them, and God gave them food. He gave them meat and bread. Now, what's interesting, that bread that he gave them is something that we've never seen since. And, the manna, this is called manna. And it started in this story, what you see right here, and it ended after they started eating of the land in the promised land, after the conquest. And we'll see that when we get to that point. Now, does anybody know what the word manna means? Do you know what the word manna means? It's a real creative word. It means, what is it? Okay, what is it? That's what they said. They looked out and they saw these thin flakes on the ground, and they said, manna. Man, you know, what is it? What is it? And so that stuck as the name. Okay, what is it? It was something from God. Okay, just like the quail were from God. And day after day, God provided them with the quail and with the manna. And it was very obvious that it had to be from God. He also kind of put a little twist on it, because remember that you got the Sabbath day to keep it holy? And so what they were to do is, on the day before the Sabbath day, they were to go and collect twice as much, so that, because there wouldn't be any manna on the Sabbath. And they were to collect twice as much so that they would have it for the Sabbath. And so that was provided, and sure enough, on the Sabbath, there was no manna. But then the next day, the manna came back again. So here you see every week they've got that reminder. And on top of that, what's interesting is, if on any other day they picked up manna and they did not eat it, whatever was left over went putrid, went bad, was filled with maggots. Okay? Except for on the Sabbath day. So here, they had a daily and weekly reminder of God being God, teaching them to put their trust in Him. One more, Exodus 17, verse 3. The people were thirsty for water there, and they grumbled against Moses. They said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us die and our children and livestock die of thirst? Okay, you see their continuing grumbling here. They should learn to trust God, right? What's with their hard-headed skulls? What's with our hard-headed skulls? Do we put our trust in God? Do we trust God to take care of us, even though He's shown us over and over and over again that He is there in control? We still fail to trust Him during many crises. Chapter 17, verse 6. Moses says, God tells Moses, I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. So a rock produced water. Something impossible, but it was possible with God, because God was there and God provided for them. So God miraculously intervened during crises and trials to teach the people to put their trust in Him. Now, did God's intervention always result in the desired results, always achieve the desired results of teaching them to put their trust in Him? Well, there's that little gotcha word of always, right? Look at Numbers 14, verse 11. The Lord said to Moses, how long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the miraculous signs that I've performed among them? So no, they continued to doubt. They continued to not put their trust in him, even though they had so many constant reminders that God was in control, that God was God, that they should put their trust in him. So, when God intervened in a crisis, why did he do so? Well, certainly he did so out of love for his people. But the big reason here, Exodus 15, and Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider, he's hurled into the sea. Okay, talking about the crossing of the Red Sea and the Egyptians that have been swallowed up by the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. He's my God, and I will praise him. My Father's God, and I will exalt him. So when God intervened in a crisis, it was to teach his people to put their trust in him, to build trust. Okay, the Jew would ask, why is God depriving me? He's not giving me any food. He's not giving me any water, all that. Instead, he should be asking for, what is God preparing me? God is teaching me to learn to put my trust in him. It's during those tough times in our lives that we can often learn the most about living and putting our trust in God. So that's the first thing, is crisis and trials were part of their experience in these wilderness wanderings to teach them to put their trust in God. The next thing we see is organization. Okay, and you can write organization down under the O of Lord, okay, on your paper here. And organization was critical in these beginning years of this new nation. This is a people who were a people but not a nation. They were a people within a nation. They lived in and followed the laws of the nation of Egypt. And all the leadership, all the organization, everything that they knew was all part of the Egyptian government. Or now they're not part of that anymore. And it's just a big group of people. And so God needs to set up organization for them to help teach them to put their trust in him. This is organization from God. Look at Exodus 18, verse 13. We see that the next day Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning until evening. In verse 17, Moses' father-in-law saw this and replied, what you're doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work's too heavy for you. You can't handle it alone. Now listen now to me, and I'll give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. And in verse 24, Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said, and he chose capable men from all of Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided for themselves. Okay? So here we see the first organization put into place, this chain of command. Okay, Moses was seen as the one who had contact with God, and so they came to him for his gift of discernment of what God wanted in a particular case. In that discernment, there was too much. Too many people. How can Moses handle all the different arguments and legal issues and whatever of millions of people? He can't. And so his father-in-law gave some sound advice, and then Moses put in this organizational chain of command. He had leaders of tens, and then fifties, and then hundreds, and then thousands. And that all worked its way on up then to Moses. And then we have the book of Numbers. And Numbers starts out dealing with numbers. And that's why we call it the book of Numbers. And take a look at the first few verses. It says, the Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting in the desert of Sinai on the first day of the second month of the second year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. So see, they're still at Mount Sinai here. He said, now take a census of the whole Israelite community by their clans and families, listing every man by name, one by one. You and Aaron are to number by their divisions all the men in Israel 20 years or more who are able to serve in the army. One man from each tribe, each the head of his family, is to help you. So they took a census. They took a census of all tribes. Okay, they did a head count. And that's what we have at the beginning of the book of Numbers, is this head count. In chapter 1, it tells you how many were in each tribe. And as you get to the end of it, then you see that it totaled 603,550. You see that in verse 46 of chapter 1. So that's where we get the name of the book of Numbers. So they took a census, but what they also did is it said that one man from each tribe, each the head of his family, is to help you. So leaders for each of the tribes were also appointed during this time. So there you've got that kind of organization. Numbers chapter 4, starting at verse 4, some scattered verses here. This is the work of the Kohathites in the tent of meeting, the care of the most holy things. Now, Kohathites was one of the tribal groups or the clans of the Levites, the tribe of Levi. Okay, so this is what the Kohathites are supposed to do. When the camp is to move, Aaron and his sons are to go in and take down the shielding curtain and cover the Ark of the Testimony with it. And then it goes on and talks about what the duties of the Kohathite clan was to be. And then verse 24, this is the service of the Gershonite clans, okay, clans of Levites, as they work and carry burdens. They're to carry the curtains of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, its covering, and the outer coverings of hides of sea cows, the curtains for the entrance of the tent of meeting, the curtains of the courtyard, and blah, 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 okay? So there you have the duties of the Gershonite clans. And then verse 29, count the Merarites by their clans and families, and goes on, talks about the Merarites. And then verse 31, this is the duty that they perform as they perform service at the tent of meeting, to carry the frames of the tabernacles, crossbars, posts, bases, etc. So specific duties for each of the Levite clans was assigned and was defined. And so there was organization there, even among the priests, on what it is that they were to do. Some other organizational things. Chapter 2. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, the Israelites are to camp around the tent of meeting, some distance from it, each man under his standard with the banners of his family. And then it goes through and specifically states how they're to be organized. So there were specific encampment orders. Each tribe would have its standard, okay, like a flag, and the tribes would gather around and settle around their flags, okay, their standards. And so there was that organization. It wasn't just these 2 million everywhere, but you take the 2 million divided into the 12 tribes, and they were to be organized by tribes. Okay? And then from that, going on in these verses, like verse 9, all the men assigned to the camp of Judah, according to their divisions, numbered 186,400, and they will set out first. Okay? So when the camp is ready to move, when God's cloud picks up and goes, saying, follow me, then the tribe of Judah would start out first. And then 16 to 17, all the men assigned to the camp of Reuben, according to their divisions, numbered 151,450, they will set out second. And then the tent of meeting and the camp of the Levites will set out in the middle of the camp. They will set out in the same order as they encamp, each in its own place under its standard. In verse 24, all the men assigned to the camp of Ephraim, according to their divisions, numbered 108,100, they will set out third. And then verse 31, all the men assigned to the camp of Dan, numbered 157,600, they will set out last under their standards. So you have this systematic breaking of camp. When the camp is to move, this is how, not everybody get up and start moving right at once. This is the order at which we're going to go. Okay? And then when we get there, this is, you settle the way that has been defined as well. So you've got that kind of organization. Now this is all organization that's needed in the wilderness. They've got 40 years in the wilderness. This is all defined right then and there, setting up this organization from the very beginning. And then Numbers 10. You know, another thing they needed was some kind of a communication system. And we see that in Numbers chapter 10. It says, the Lord said to Moses, make two trumpets of hammered silver and use them for calling the community together and for having the camp set out. When both trumpets are sounded, the whole community is to assemble before you at the entrance to the tent of meeting. If only one trumpet sounded, the leaders, the heads of the clans of Israel, are to assemble before you. This orderly communication system. They didn't have email, they didn't have telephones, they didn't have walkie-talkies. Instead, they had trumpets. And so they set out different kinds of blasts. If you go on, you can see about some other blasts about setting out and all that. So they had this different scheme. Whenever you heard one blast or two blasts or two trumpets or one trumpet or whatever, this is what it meant. And so that's how they would communicate with everyone. Organization. From the very early on, organizational methods were put into place to organize this group of people that had been slaves. Okay, they hadn't been leaders, they had been slaves. They hadn't been trained in leadership. They'd been slaves. But God, through Moses, brought some organization. Through his instructions to Moses, brought organization to this group to help teach them. This is an organization from God to teach them to put their trust in him. Okay, the next one is law and legislation. Law and legislation. You can put law and legislation under the L of Lord, okay, on your paper. Now, what is it that God insisted on? Exodus chapter 22, verse 20, and then also chapter 23. Okay, this is in the civil law section, remember, chapters 21 through 23. So 22 verse 20 says, "Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord must be destroyed." In chapter 23, starting at verse 32, "Do not make a covenant with them," these other peoples, "or with their gods. Do not let them live in your land, or they'll become to you, they will cause you to sin against me, because the worship of their gods will certainly be a snare to you." So God demanded pure worship. Okay, do not worship other gods. That's one of the commandments in Exodus chapter 20. What is the very beginning? "You shall have no other gods before me." From that was what God insisted on. Pure worship. Pure worship of God. And then Exodus 23, verses 6 to 8. "Do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuits. Have nothing to do with a false charge, and do not put an innocent or honest person to death, for I will not acquit the guilty. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds those who see and twists the words of the righteous." He also insisted on pure justice. The things he insisted on was a pure relationship with him and pure relationships with one another, which really is what we have in the Ten Commandments. Okay, the first three commandments dealing with our relationship with God. And Jesus summed that up saying the greatest commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. You know what? If you do that, you're not going to have any other gods before him. You're not going to take the name of the Lord your God in vain. You're going to remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. You're going to obey God. And then the other commands deal with the pure justice, the pure dealing with other people, okay? How we interact with other people. And Jesus summed that up by saying the second commandment is just like it. It says, love your neighbor as yourself. And if you love your neighbor as yourself, you're not going to kill him. You're not going to lie about him. You're not going to covet. You're not going to commit adultery against him. You're not going to steal from him. Okay? And so you have all those commands that fall under that. So that's what God did in bringing out the law, is he gave these laws, this basic set of rules to start the nation on the right foot based around pure justice and pure worship of him. We see that there were some special, unique laws that they had to have as they wandered around the wilderness for 40 years that are kind of unique that we don't really see today. Exodus 22, 26 to 27 says, "If you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it to him by sunset, because his cloak is the only covering he has for his body. What else will he sleep in? When he cries out to me, I will hear, for I'm compassionate." So people lived in close contact with one another. And so there's some special laws that dealt with dealing with each other in close contact. And not only with each other, but also look at chapter 21, verses 33 to 34. "If a man uncovers a pit or digs one and fails to cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit must pay for the loss. He must pay its owner, and the dead animal will be his." They also would live, these 40 years, in close proximity with each other's livestock, okay, with animals. And so you had to deal with each other's property and livestock, and there's a lot of laws that dealt with that. Okay? So there's laws in here that they needed as a new nation that really don't make a lot of sense today because it's different. And if you take a look, there's three types of laws that you find in here. Okay, we've already said Exodus 21 through 23 is the civil law, right? That's your memory concept. Civil law for nomads, okay? These are civil laws dealing with how these people would wander for 40 years, would get along with each other. Now, does civil law change? Yes. we've got a legislature that exists for the sole purpose of changing the laws, of making up new ones, deleting old ones, modifying old ones. That's what the legislature does. And that's always needed because times change, cultures change, things change, new ideas come up, all of that. Now, God kick-started this new nation of Israel with a set of laws, and that's what we have in Exodus 21, 23, and a little bit elsewhere too. The only laws that they knew were the laws that they had under when they were under the Egyptians. But those were not qualified for God's people, so they had laws given to them by God to kick-start them, to get them started. Then we also see a number of other types of laws that are ceremonial laws. The book of Leviticus is jam-packed with that. Okay, these are laws on how to deal with God, how to relate to God. You know, where the civil laws are dealing with each other, the ceremonial laws deal with God. The emphasis there is on sacrifice. Okay, where the emphasis on dealing with others is on justice and mercy, the emphasis here is on sacrifice to God, giving yourself to God. That's what God wants. Okay, does this evolve? Yes, it does change over time. The laws that you see here, you see a lot of laws about the tent of tabernacle and how it's to be built and set up and all that. Well, eventually, they didn't have the tabernacle, they had a temple. So those laws no longer applied. And then the temple wasn't there, they did synagogues and all that. And what about us? We've got multiple forms of worship. Which one's right? They're all right, okay? This can change as we change because God doesn't change. But we change, and how we relate to God then might change as a result in our ceremonial aspects. And then the third type of law is the moral law. That's what we see in Exodus 20. Okay, that's just one example of God's moral law. These Ten Commandments that are God's unchanging laws. God doesn't change. His standards don't change. Moral law doesn't change. So what we have in Exodus 20 applies to us today as much as it applied to the people thousands of years ago. Okay? Now, as you look at these laws, you've got to recognize that the laws were made for a people, not a person. Okay? The laws were made for a people, not a person. God's plan was bigger than the individual. It was bigger than the corporate group. It was bigger than all of Israel. God's plan was for all people of all time, right? And so the laws that he put in place for his chosen people, for them to be able to be a blessing, and through them bless others, and through them all people on earth would be blessed, they had to be God's perfect laws that would empower and enable them to fulfill that destiny. Now, God's laws defined health for Israel. Okay, it was essential for them for fulfilling the destiny. Any sins against God's law would threaten Israel's health. Okay, as people would go against what God commanded in the civil laws, or in the ceremonial laws, or in his moral law, that would threaten their health and their ability to fulfill their destiny, and so those had to be dealt with very strictly. Okay, it had to be cut out like a cancer. And we deal with that in Corinthians. Paul talks about that with the situation that the church in Corinth had, and we definitely had that in the early church. We also had that here in these wilderness wanderings. And let's look at some examples of that. Because what we come up with next, another thing that God used to teach them to trust in the Lord was rigid discipline. You can put rigid discipline there under the R and the D of the Lord. And in fact, now that we're on page 4, you can see how that all lays out. Okay? So, to be God's chosen people and to be a blessing, these people needed to be strictly disciplined. So let's look at some of that. Exodus 32 verses 1 through 6. This is a story that you should know. You've seen it in the movie. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, "Hey, come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him." Aaron answered, "Okay, well, take off the gold earrings that your wives and your sons and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me." So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. He took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord." So the next day the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterward, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry. So here you have the story of the golden calf. While Moses was up on Mount Sinai with God, okay, receiving this law and legislation that God was prescribing, they turned from God. And they made this golden calf, a golden calf similar to what they had seen in Egypt. And they worshipped it. They made an altar towards it. They turned from God and worshipped other gods. This people who are supposed to be the window for the rest of the world into what it means to serve God. And they're already, early on, rejecting Him. How did God deal with that? Verse 27. Then He said to him, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man, strap a sword to his side, go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other." He's talking to the Levites here. "Each killing his brother and friend and neighbor." The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. Verse 35. And the Lord struck the people with a plague because of what they had did with the calf that Aaron had made. So as a result of this great sin of turning from God, making another God, worshiping that God, God responded with executions and a plague that killed many people. That sounds like some pretty rigid discipline. But was it important? At this infancy part of stage of this nation, it was very important. They needed to be reminded who they were dealing with, who was in control, who they were there to worship, who had called them. That is none other than the one and only God. And so they were taught with this rigid discipline to put their trust in that God. Another one, Leviticus. Let's go to get some stories out of Leviticus. Chapter 10, verse 1. Aaron's son Nadab and Abihu took their censers and put fire in them and added incense, and they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord contrary to His command. So here we have Aaron's sons. Aaron was the high priest, the chief priest. These guys were priests. These were Levites. And every day they would light incense and they would, you know, do these things that God told them to do. But at one point they decided to make up some of their own ceremonial laws and they lit some unauthorized fire. Well, that doesn't sound like a big deal, does it? But it is. You turn away from God's command. You take someone who's a leader like these men. People would look to them. And they would lead people astray by not doing what God commanded. And they did something that God didn't command. They abused their religious duties here. And what happened? Verse 2. So fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. God killed them for offering this unauthorized incense. That is rigid discipline. When the people saw this, when the people heard this, what do you think they thought? They knew who was in charge. They knew who was in power. They knew who God is, right? So this strengthened their trust in Him. Leviticus 24, verse 11. The son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name with a curse, so they brought him to Moses. His mother's name was Shelemith, and the daughter of Dibri the Danite. Okay, that was important to somebody. So here we have an Israelite that curses God. He cursed God. People heard that, and so they brought him to Moses. Okay, well, people say curse words about God all the time. But these are the chosen people of God, the people who are to reveal God to others. How does God respond in rigid discipline here? Verse 13. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the blasphemer outside the camp. All those who heard him are to lay their hands on his head, and the entire assembly is to stone him." He is executed by stoning by the people. The people, God made sure that they were in on this, that they saw this, that they understood who is in control. How likely are any of these people going to blaspheme God, going to curse God now? Okay? This taught them that God is God, to put their trust in God. Okay, let's go to Numbers. Numbers chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he had married a Cushite. Well, is that a problem? Well, yeah, because God prescribed separation, ethnic separation, right? So that wasn't a very good example. And they started talking against him. They said, has the Lord spoken only through Moses, they asked? Hadn't he also spoken through us? And the Lord heard this. Now Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. So here we have Miriam and Aaron saying, hey, who does Moses think he is? God talks to us too. Okay, and he's obviously not perfect with God because he's got this Cushite wife. Well, were any of God's servants perfect? No. But what Miriam is doing here and Aaron is talking down about God's selection of Moses. And Moses is the representative of God to the people here, and they are talking that down. There's a jealousy here. How does God deal with this? Verse 9. I'm actually going to start out at verse 4. Okay, we'll just continue on the story. At once the Lord said to Moses, Aaron and Miriam, come out to the tent of meeting, all three of you. So the three of them came out. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud. He stood at the entrance of the tent and summoned Aaron and Miriam. When both of them stepped forward, he said, listen to my words. When a prophet of the Lord is among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams. But this isn't true of my servant Moses. He's faithful in all my house. With him I speak face to face, clearly and not in riddles. He sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Well, the anger of the Lord burned against them and he left them. Then the cloud lifted from above the tent and there stood Miriam, leprous like snow. Aaron turned toward her and saw that she had leprosy. He said to Moses, please, my Lord, don't hold this against us, this sin that we so foolishly committed. So leprosy. And people saw this. People saw that yes, Moses is the top leader, but Aaron and Miriam are right up there with him. And here, when they started talking bad about Moses, the word of this got out. People saw this. She was leprous. She walked around with leprosy. And people saw that. And that helped build their respect and trust in God. And then one more. Numbers chapter 16, verse 3. They came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron and said to them, you've gone too far. The whole community is holy, every one of them. And the Lord's with them. Then why do you set yourselves among the Lord's assembly? So here we have this rebellion started by this guy named Korah and also Dathan and Abiram. You can see that up in verse 1 of chapter 16. And they stood up against Moses and said, hey, who do you think you are? You know, we're all holy people. See, we're part of this holy community. And what makes you think you're better than any of the rest of us? So we have a disrespect for authority. You know, similar to what we saw before. How did God deal with this? Using rigid discipline. Verse 31. As soon as he finished saying all this, the ground under them split apart and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them with their households and all of Korah's men and all their possessions. They went down alive into the grave with everything they owned. The earth closed over them and they perished and were gone from the community. So they were swallowed up by the earth, out in the desert, this earthquake kind of thing. It opened up and the ones who were responsible for disrespecting the authority that God had given to Moses were eaten up. The others were not. Okay? So you saw this rigid discipline. All of this rigid discipline then served to train these people to put their trust in God. So again, all these wilderness wandering experiences, God used those to form his new nation through these things to teach them to trust in the Lord. These crises and trials that they experienced, the law and legislation that God put in place for them, the organization that he set up, the rigid discipline that they experienced, all of those were there in the wilderness wanderings to teach them to put their trust in him so that they would then be able to fulfill their destiny as God continued to carry out his plan. Now, on a note here, our in-depth research project for next week, someone will go through kind of similar to what we did when we looked at the uniting factors. And we, at that time, we looked at the uniting factors and said, okay, what similar uniting factors do we have as Christians, as the New Testament Israel? Well, we want to do the same things now. What kind of things has God put into place? What similar approaches has he used with the New Testament Israel to teach us to put our trust in the Lord in order to be able to fulfill our destiny of being blessed to be a blessing? You may want to think about that on your own too. and think through some of these various aspects of that. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you've given us, the lessons that you've taught us, the concepts that you show us that we're to put our trust in you. That you personally cared so much about your relationship with the Israelites, your relationship with all people that would be fulfilled through the destiny that you fulfilled that you completed through the Israelites, that you personally intervened in the 40 years that they had. You took care of them. You showed them your hand everywhere through crises and trials, through law, through organization, through rigid discipline. You revealed yourself to them so that they would and could put their trust in you, so that they would be enabled and empowered to fulfill your destiny. Keep us mindful of the things that you've put in place for us to teach us how to put our trust in you, just as you have called them to this unique destiny of being blessed to be a blessing. You have likewise called us to be blessed to be a blessing. And thank you for that calling and that destiny. In Christ's name, amen.